This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today it's a medical nutritional update. I've got a bunch of stories that I've been wanting to share with you, but they've ended up on the cutting room floor, unfortunately, because during my weekend broadcast, when I generally do a potpourri of the week's nutritional stories, we've been just getting an enormous number of phone calls, which is to the good because it's a call-in show, but it's left me with a lot of extra copy that I've wanted to share with you. So this is something we're going to do from time to time, and I hope that you find it interesting. We're going to do sort of a lightning round of stories that I think are of interest from a medical standpoint and nutritional standpoint. So here it goes. This story I have found just fascinating, and I wanted to circle back to it. I made mention of it during a recent radio program, but it has to do with the proposition, "Are smartphones making us stupid?" That's the title of an article in last month's Psychology Today by Christopher Berglund. And it's based on a report, ingenious series of studies from the University of Texas at Austin, entitled "Brain Drain: The Mere Presence of One's Own Smartphone Reduces Available Cognitive Capacity." So here's the phenomenon. It turns out that when a smartphone is even on your body, when you're carrying it, much less looking at it, your ability to perform tasks is impaired. Okay, we can understand that, you know, if you're walking down the street, as many people are, and they're trying to multitask, they're trying to navigate New York City streets, and they bump into you because they're looking at their smartphone. Obviously, the smartphone is using up some of the brain's buffering capacity, and therefore your navigational abilities are impaired. That's a no-brainer. But it was fascinating that in this study, University of Texas Austin researchers found that someone's ability to hold and process data significantly improved if his or her smartphone was in another room while taking a test that measured attentional control and cognitive processes. So in other words, the smartphone had to be, it not only did it have to be face down on the table or in your pocket, even if it was in your pocket, somehow it took up some of your brain's processing capacity just by being around. Even if the phone was turned off and face down on the desk, the mere sight of one's own smartphone seemed to, quote, induce brain drain by depleting finite cognitive resources. This, according to the article in Scientific American. this is of interest because I guess it adds to the assertion that our smartphones are making us dumb. Another study performed last year in 2016 reported the typical smartphone owner interacts with his or her phone an average of 85 times per day. Okay? Some people even wake up in the middle of the night to check their smartphones. And this is an interesting phenomenon. And actually, there's some broader implications to this. I've been doing a lot of research on paleo man, proto-humans who are around say 50 or 100,000 years ago, or even 500,000 years ago. We had proto-human precursors. Actually, humans were relatively biologically similar to the way we are now, with similar brain sizes and similar intelligence, even 50 or 100,000 years ago, when technology was extremely limited and we were all hunter-gatherers. And when you think of these folks, you tend to think of them as, you know, kind of like, hey, ugh, you know, bring me that rock. You know, that they just were very primitive, and that these days we're so much smarter. But actually, in order to exploit the very, very challenging environments that they lived in, it's likely that these folks were very, very smart. In fact, they had to deal with a lot of things that we sort of take for granted. They had to deal with the seasons. They had to deal with predators. They had to find food. They had to deal with complex social interactions, because they lived tribally in small social units, but they had to keep track of everybody without Facebook. And it is possible that we are evolving in the digital age to be less smart. We're parking some of our mental capacity with the devices that we use to download our memories to. I mean, a lot of what primitive man had to deal with, and modern hunter-gatherers, although they're rapidly disappearing in their pristine environments, a lot of what was dealt with on the basis of memory. Memory was important. And now, even in education, there's a lot less of memorization. There's a lot more of you don't need to know this. You just know how to know how to look it up. And that's sort of where we are offloading our intelligence to the devices that support us. And so our brain ecosystem partakes of computers and smart devices. It all began with the calculator. In the old days, they used to teach arithmetic to kids. They used to do, and we did, we learned how to do multiplication and long division. Now, kids without a calculator would be helpless to do a mental calculation. And so this speaks to the issue of overall, are all these smart devices making us dumber? Are they really extending our cognitive ability, or are they making our brains less supple and more lazy? Well, that's a matter for us to speculate on as we become more and more synchronous with our devices. Our devices ultimately may sap our brains. Okay, I've got a story here that I think is of immense significance for those attempting to diet. You know, there's so many ways to diet these days, you know, low fat, low carb, and there's all kinds of diet gimmicks. But here's a diet that could make a lot of sense, and it's ultra simple. And in this story, what they feature is a picture of two rats side by side. And one is a big fat rat, and the other one is a slim rat. And one of them underwent a special intervention which enabled them to lose a lot of weight. And what was that intervention? Well, they knocked out that rat's sense of smell. The headline here, smelling your food makes you fat. Actually, I misspoke. It's about mice. Mice that lost sense of smell stayed slim on a high-fat diet while their litter mates ballooned in weight. Okay? What they did is they deliberately fed mice a high-fat diet. And, you know, I'm not going to comment on whether this is an indictment of a high-fat diet for humans, because we tend to do a lot of experiments with rodents who are primarily vegetarians on a grain diet, and we give them a high-fat diet to make them fat. Humans are different, and high-fat diets don't necessarily make humans fat, especially when humans control for carbohydrates. But that's another story. What they found is that super smellers gained more weight than did normal mice on the same high-fat diet. And smell-deficient mice burned excess fat instead of storing it, suggesting a link between smell and metabolism. Now, that's interesting because you may say, well, okay, yeah, they lost weight because the food, you know, didn't taste like anything. It was bland, so they lost interest in eating. But actually, there may have been some complex signaling that was going on in the brain that is linked to the olfactory input. And that once you smell something, it may kick your fat-storing apparatus into high gear, thus enabling you to retain weight. So this is a very interesting study. So the implication is, you know, put a clothespin over your nose or use nose plugs. Well, no, because in this case, they used a special technique to knock out olfactory neurons in the noses of adult mice. They used a gene therapy technique. It's called a knockout technique. But it spared the stem cells. Stem cells are cells that can regenerate in the olfactory neurons. And so this is a temporary knockout. It wasn't a permanent knockout. You know, humans who lose the taste of the sense of smell or taste, this is a very miserable situation for them. And it's called hypoagusia or agusia, and it's a terrible situation. But these animals lost their sense of smell only temporarily for about 3 weeks before their olfactory neurons regrew. And it's interesting that the smell-deficient mice rapidly burn calories by upregulating their sympathetic nervous system, which is known to increase fat burning. So this wasn't just about, well, if you can't smell the food, you're less interested in eating. It had to do with a real change in their metabolism. The findings suggest that the odor of what we eat may play an important role in how the body deals with calories. If you can't smell your food, you may burn it rather than store it. So, you know, could a simple clothespin suffice, or do we have to use sophisticated genetic techniques to knock out our smell temporarily? That would be kind of cool, right? You know, a diet program that would say over a period of 6 months on a human scale, you know, 3 months for a mouse. I mean, 3 weeks for a mouse is a little bit like 6 months in a human because they live less long. Maybe a six-month knockout on the humans would be helpful. On the negative side, you know, there's always some potential consequence. The loss of smell was accompanied by a surge in levels of the hormone adrenaline. And that's a stress response tied to the sympathetic nervous system, a fight or flight response. And in humans, such a sustained rise in this hormone might lead to a heart attack or certainly high blood pressure, potentially a stroke. So, yeah, maybe this is of limited practicality for people. But hey, a fascinating look at how smell, you know, it. You think, you know, it almost suggests that if you go to, you know, a pizza place and you say, I'm just going to smell it. You know, I'm not going to indulge. I'm going to just stand outside this pizza smell and imbibe the wonderful aromas. That in itself could make you gain weight. These days, I don't eat pizza, but, you know, I got to say that when I walk past a pizza place, it smells awfully good. Or a place, you know, where they make pastry. Just the smell alone could make you gain weight, according to this study. Okay, I'm not a big fan of working things out in the courts when they are not to your liking. But I got to say that I do like this particular consumer activist legislation against Hain Food Company. It's actually called Hain Celestial Group, which makes a product called Garden Veggie Straws. And the if you look at the product, the label shows what looks like sort of thin, crispy French fries, but they're green and orange and yellow. And the suggestion is that they're sort of healthy versions of a snack. And two snack-loving men feel that they were duped by Hain Celestial Group after discovering that there are no actual vegetables in the company's popular garden veggie straws. It comes in bags with photos of spinach, a tomato, and a potato on the front. So it's suggesting that, you know, what you're getting is you're getting the essence of vegetables distilled into a tasty, crispy snack. Well, in their court filings, these two individuals who are Mr. Solak, John Solak, and Jim Figure. These two individuals in their court filings claim that garden veggie straws, quote, do not contain any of the actual vibrantly depicted vegetables and are instead, quote, misleading consumers who, quote, consciously seek out healthy foods and snacks. If you look at the ingredient list of garden veggie straws, it includes some salt, some starch, and a lot of bologna, and not vine-ripened tomatoes. Not literally bologna, but figurative bologna, because the actual ingredients are potato starch, corn starch, tomato paste, and some spinach powder. Now, there are actual groups that, and mostly these are sort of conservative groups, that are pushing it back against frivolous lawsuits. There's an outfit called the Lawsuit Reform Alliance of New York, whose executive director, Tom Stebbins, says, these courtroom food fights are not about consumer protection. They say that the Hain suit is, quote, just another absurd cash grab by money-hungry trial lawyers. And that's part of the problem, is that there are attorneys out there who kind of specialize in this. And yeah, they feel they're doing some good, but what they end up doing is, you know, through class action suits, they make a lot of money, because usually these things settle, right? I mean, what, you're going to like fight this? So there's some settlement, and the settlement could be a big settlement, you know, multiple thousands of dollars. And the lawyers end up taking, you know, 30-40%. And then the consumers in the class action lawsuit, they don't get very much. You know, they may get like a little rebate of, you know, a few dollars for the money that they spend on the products. But it's the lawyers who make out like bandits on this. And virtually every company around is a target. It is open season on companies that make claims that may not be entirely accurate or exaggerated. And so, nonetheless, I take the side of these two irate consumers who feel duped by the misrepresentation that garden veggie straws actually contain vegetables. I think that's pretty egregious, because they got a little bit of vegetable flavoring and they don't impart the benefits of true vegetables. Okay, expectant moms, listen up, because I'm sure you don't want your kid to be allergic or suffer from asthma. And, you know, there are many studies looking at dietary effects during pregnancy, is that you actually shape the palate of your baby to some extent. You may increase or decrease your child's risk of obesity by virtue of your diet. You can even impact your child's attention whether or not they're more likely to get attention deficit disorder. You can certainly reduce your child's risk of having a neural tube defect or autism, or worse yet, some sort of alcohol-related brain problem, because there's something called FAS, fetal alcohol syndrome. So what you're doing during pregnancy is pretty important. But here's an association that has just been discovered. Researchers at Queen Mary University of London have found that sugar intake during pregnancy is associated with both allergy and allergic asthma in children. Okay. There was a strong positive association with allergy and allergic asthma. When comparing the 20% of mothers with the highest sugar intake versus the 20% of mothers with the lowest sugar intake, there was an increased risk of 38% for allergy in the offspring. And 73% for allergy to two or more allergens, and over 100% for allergic asthma. There was no association with eczema or hay fever, however. So what's going on here? Well, sugar affects the microbiome. It may cause yeast to arise in the gastrointestinal tract of mom, thus priming the baby's immune system in the wrong direction, or simply the mix of bacteria in the mom's intestine that are changed by sugar intake may impact the child's developing immune system. Or alternatively, sugar may be pro-inflammatory. It may in some way flip the switch on the infant's developing immune system. It's not clear precisely why, but your diet during pregnancy is ultra crucial when it comes to the outcome of when you deliver your child. Okay, you patients out there who are taking medication, is the choice of medication that your doctor prescribes to you, is it dependent on the quality of the pen that the pharmaceutical industry representative gave as a compliment to your doctor, or to a lobster dinner? And according to Journal of the American Medical Association, the answer is yes. Pharmaceutical industry-sponsored meals are associated with higher prescribing rates. So perhaps you're taking that drug because of a fancy dinner that your doctor was taken out to. Accepting a single pharmaceutical industry-sponsored meal was associated with higher rates of prescribing certain drugs to Medicare patients by physicians, with more and costlier meals associated with greater increases in prescribing. They looked at nearly 280,000 physicians receiving nearly 64,000 payments, payments being in the form of meals that have an average value of less than $20. Wow, pretty cheap meals. I don't think you could do that in New York City. Statin drugs, pretty popular. Beta blocker drugs, blood pressure medications, and psychiatric drugs were among the most frequently associated with free meals to doctors taken out to lunch or dinner by pharmaceutical representatives. And from the standpoint of doctors, you know, I used to say, you know, if not for those pharmaceutical representatives, we wouldn't eat very well in the hospitals. We used to love it when the pharmaceutical reps would come in and they would buy like these, 6 foot long heroes for us starving medical interns. And we would just love it because, you know, whether or not this influenced our prescribing, I'm not sure. Maybe it did at a subconscious level, but we love those pharmaceutical reps because they would bring us the best sandwiches. And oh, by the way, their pens were pretty good when they didn't leak onto our white coats. So this still goes on. I tell you, this practice has been dramatically curtailed, And a lot of doctors kind of lament that. They think, oh, you know, the good old days, we used to get a lot of good stuff, and now we're no longer getting that good stuff because it just ain't what it used to be. In the good old days, we used to get trips, we used to get fancier meals, and now the government is cracking down on drug companies because, in effect, these are bribes. These are bribes to induce doctors to prescribe sometimes costly and unnecessary medications because, well, just keep those meals flowing and those gifts coming. All right, we're going to pause because we divide our podcast into two parts. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. This week, we're doing a medical nutritional update, and we'll have more to share with you in part two. So stay with us. This is Intelligent Medicine.